not be happy. He'll stop being so grouchy. True, there's a grouchy part she'll have to guide him through first. The part where he'll say, it's sure to be a scam like everything else. It's some kind of rip-off. And why bother applying, because they won't get in. But nothing ventured, nothing gained, she'll say. And why don't they just try? She'll persuade him to do it, one way or another. Worst comes to worst, she'll dangle the promise of sex. Sex in a luxurious king-sized bed with clean sheets. Wouldn't stand like that. With no maniacs trying to break in through the window. If necessary, she'll even put up with that cramped backseat car ordeal tonight as a reward if he says yes. It won't be that much fun for her, but fun can wait until later, until they're inside their new house.
Part 3. Switch. Gateway. Getting into the Positron Project won't be a slam dunk. They aren't interested in just anyone, as Charmaine whispers to Stan on the bus that's picked them up from the parking lot collection point. Some of the people on the bus can't possibly make it into the project. They're too worn down and leathery, with blackened or missing teeth. Stan wonders if there's a dental plan in there. So far, there's nothing wrong with his own teeth. Lucky, considering all the cheap, sugary crap they've been eating. Sandy and Veronica are on the bus, too, sitting at the back and nibbling on the sack full of cold chicken wings they've brought with them. Every once in a while, they laugh, a little too loudly. Everyone on this bus is nervous, Charmaine especially.
What if we get rejected? She asks Stan. What if we get accepted?
She says it's like being picked for sports teams when she was at school. You're nervous either way. The bus trip goes on for hours in a steady drizzle. Through open countryside, past strip malls with plywood over most of the windows, derelict burger joints. Only the gas stations appear functional. After a while, Charmaine falls asleep with her head on Stan's shoulder. His arm is around her. He draws her closer. He, too, dozes off. He's awake by the time the bus stops at a gateway in a high black glass wall. Solar generation, thinks Stan. Smart, building it in like that. The group on the bus wakes, stretches, descends. It's late afternoon. As if on cue, mellow sunlight breaks through the clouds, lighting them in a golden glow. Many are smiling. They file in past the seeing eye boundary, then through the entrance cubicle, where their eyes are scanned and their fingerprints taken, and a plastic pass card with a number on it and a barcode is issued to each of them. Back on the bus, they're driven through the town of Consilience, where the project is located. Charmaine says she can hardly believe her eyes. Everything is so spruced up, it's like a picture. Like a town in a movie of years ago. Like the olden days, before anyone was born. She squeezes Stan's hand in anticipation, and he squeezes back.
This is the right thing to do, she says.
They get off the bus in front of the Harmony Hotel, which is not only the top hotel in town, says the neatly dressed young man who's now in charge of them. It's the only hotel, because Consilience isn't exactly a tourist destination. He herds them into a preliminary drinks and snacks party in the ballroom. You're free to leave at any time, he tells them, if you don't like the ambiance. He grins to show this is a joke. Because what's not to like about the ambiance? Stan rolls an olive around in his mouth before chewing. It's a long time since he's had an olive. The taste is distracting. He should be more alert, because naturally they're being scrutinized, though it's hard to figure out who's doing it. Everyone is so fucking nice. The niceness is like the olive. It's a long time since Stan has encountered that muffling layer of smiling and nodding. Who knew he's such a fascinating dude? Not him, but there are three women, obvious hostesses. They even have name badges, deployed to convince him of his own magnetism. He scans the room. There's Charmaine, getting a similar treatment from two dudes and a girl. Her slutty hooker friends from Pixel Dust are in that group, too. They've fixed themselves up. They even have dresses on. You wouldn't really spot them as pros. Throughout the evening, the crowd gets thinner. A discreet weeding, Stan guesses. All those with bad attitudes, out the discard door. But Stan and Charmaine must have passed scrutiny, because here they still are, at the end of the party. Everyone remaining is given a room reservation for later. They also get a meal voucher, with a carafe of wine included, and another young man steers them toward a restaurant called Together, just down the street. There's an old-fashioned tune playing in the background. White tablecloths. A plush carpet.
Oh, Stan!
Charmaine breathes at him over the electric candles on their table for two.
It's like a dream come true.
She picks up the rose from their bud vase, sniffs it. It's not real, Stan wants to tell her. But why spoil it for her? She's so happy. That night, they stay at the Harmony Hotel. Charmaine has two baths. She gets so turned on by the towels. Less so by him, Stan guesses. But still, she comes across for him. So why complain?
There,
she says afterwards.
Isn't this better than the back seat of the car?
If they commit to the positron project, she says, they can kiss that horrible car goodbye and good riddance, and the vandals and thieves can tear it apart, because they themselves won't need it anymore. Night out. The next day, the workshops begin. After the first one, they'll still be free to leave, they are told. In fact, they'll have to leave, because Positron wants you to take a good look at the alternatives before deciding. As they have good reason to know, it's a festering scrap heap out beyond the Consilience gates. People are starving, scavenging, pilfering, dumpster diving. Is that any way for a human being to live? So each one of them will spend what the Positron Project hopes, what it sincerely hopes, will be their last night on the outside. To give them time to think it over, seriously. The project isn't interested in freeloaders, tourists just trying it out. The project wants serious commitment. Because after that night, you were either out or you were in. In was permanent. But no one would force you. If you signed up, it would be of your own free will. The first day's workshop is mostly PowerPoints. It begins with videos of the town of Consilience, with happy people at work in it, doing ordinary jobs. Butcher, baker, plumber, scooter repair, and so on. Then there are videos of the Positron prison inside Consilience, with happy people at work in it as well, each one of them wearing an orange boiler suit. Stan only half watches. He already knows they're going to sign the commitment papers tomorrow, because Charmaine has her heart set on it. Despite the slightly uneasy feeling he's had, they've both had, because Charmaine said at breakfast, with lattes and real grapefruit,
"Honey, are you sure?"
The bath towels clinched the deal. Their night outside the wall is spent in a nasty motel that Stan wagers has been tailored for the purpose, with the furniture trashed to order, stale cigarette smell sprayed on, cockroaches imported, and sounds of violent revelry in the room next door, most likely a recording. But it's enough like the real thing to make the world inside the Consilience wall seem more desirable than ever. Most likely, it is the real thing. Because why fake it when there's so much actual wreckage available? In view of the racket and the lumpy mattress, they have trouble getting to sleep. So Stan hears the tapping at the window immediately.
Yo, Stan! Fuck! Now what?
He draws back the ragged curtain, peers cautiously out.
It's Connor, with his two looming sidekicks watching his back. Connor, he says. What the fuck?
At least it's Con and not some lunatic with a crowbar.
Aye, bro, says Con. Come out. I need to talk to you. Fuck, Now? Stan says. Would I say need if I didn't need?
Honey, what is it?
Says Charmaine, holding the sheet up to her chin.
It's only my brother, says Stan.
He's pulling on his clothes.
Connor? Why is he here?
She doesn't like Con. She never has. She thinks he's a bad influence who will lead Stan astray. As if he's that easy to lead. Con might get him into behavior she doesn't approve of, like too much drinking and darker stuff she'll never elaborate on. But she most likely means whores.
Don't go out there, Stan. He might...
I can handle it, says Stan. He's my brother, for fuck's sake.
Don't leave me alone in here,
she says fearfully.
It's too scary. Wait, I'll come with you.
Is this an act to keep him tethered so Con can't spirit him away to a den of vice?
You stay in bed, honey. I'll be right outside, he says, with what he hopes is gentle reassurance.
Muffled sniffling from the bed. Trust Con to turn up and mess with everyone's head. Stan slides himself out the door.
What?
He says as irritably as he can manage.
Don't sign into that thing,
says Connor. He's close to whispering.
Trust me on it. You don't want to.
How do you know where to find me? Says Stan.
What's the phone for? I gave it to you. So I traced it, dum-dum. I tracked you on that bus all the way here. Lesson one, don't take phones from strangers,
says Connor, grinning.
You're not a fucking stranger, says Stan.
Right. So I'm telling you straight up, don't trust that package, no matter what they tell you.
Why not? Says Stan. What's wrong with it?
What's wrong with it is, unless you're top management, you can't get out. Except in a box, feet first, says Connor. I'm just looking out for you is all. What are you trying to tell me? You don't know what goes on in there, says Con.
Meaning what? Meaning you do?
I've heard stuff, says Connor. It's not for you. Nice guys finish last. Or else they get finished. You're too soft.
Stan juts out his chin. That would have been the signal for a scuffle once upon a time.
You're fucking paranoid, he says.
Yeah, right.
Don't say I didn't warn you, says Con.
Do yourself a favor. Stay outside. Listen, your family. I'll help you out, the same as you helped me. You need a job, some cash, a favor. You know where I am. You're always welcome.
And the little lady.
Bring her along, too.
Con grins. There's a place for her anytime. So that's it. Con has his poacher's eye on Charmaine.
No fucking way in hell is Stan falling for that one.
Thanks, buddy, he says. I appreciate it. I'll think about it.
Like shit, says Connor.
But he smiles cheerfully, and the two of them do the back pat.
Stan?
Comes the anxious voice of Charmaine from inside their room.
Go comfort the little wifey, says Connor.
And Stan knows what he's thinking.
Pussy whipped.
He watches Con walking away with his two bodyguards. They get into a long black car, which slides off into the night, silent as a submarine. Most likely the same car he saw at the trailer park. Guys like Con, who score some money, always want cars like that. Not that Stan would mind having such a car himself. Twin City. The next morning, they take the final step. Stan barely even read the terms and conditions, because Charmaine is so eager to get in. After all, they've been chosen, she says, and so many have been rejected. She smiles mistily at Stan as he signs his name on the form.
Oh, thank you, she says. I feel so safe.
Then the workshops begin in earnest, or as one of the leaders quips, they've had the shop, now they're getting the work. They are about to learn so many astounding new things, and it will require their full concentration. Men's workshops over here, ladies over there, because there will be different challenges and duties and expectations for each. And besides, They'll be separated for a month at a time when they're in the prison part of this project, a feature that will be explained more fully to them shortly. So they might as well start getting used to it, their first workshop leader says with a chuckle. Anyway, abstinence makes the heart grow fonder, as he is sure they know from experience. Another chuckle. Be a loner, get a boner, thinks Stan. A rhyme of teenaged Connor, who'd had a collection of rhymes like that. He watches as Charmaine and all of the other women in the group leave the room. Sandy and Veronica don't look back, but Charmaine does. She smiles brightly at Stan to show him she's confident about their decision, though she looks a little anxious. But then, he's a little anxious himself. What are these astounding new things they're about to learn? The men's workshop leaders are half a dozen young, earnest, dark-suited, zit-picking graduates of some globally funded think tank's motivational speaking program. In his past life, the part of it he'd spent at Dimple Robotics, Stan encountered the type. He disliked them before. But, as before, they can't be avoided, since the workshop classes are mandatory. In a jam-packed day of back-to-back sessions, they're given the full song and dance. The rationale for consilience, its history, the potential obstacles to it, the odds ranged against it, and why it is so imperative that those odds be overcome. The Consilience Positron Twin City is an experiment. An ultra, ultra important experiment. The think tankers use the word ultra at least 10 times. If it succeeds, and it has to succeed, and it can succeed if they all work together, it could be the salvation, not only of the many regions that have been so hard hit in recent times, but eventually, if this model comes to be adopted at the highest levels, of the nation as a whole. Unemployment and crime solved in one fell swoop, with a new life for all those concerned. Think about that. They themselves, the incoming positron planners, they're heroic. They've chosen to risk themselves, to take a gamble on the brighter side of human nature, to chart unknown territories within the psyche. They're like the early pioneers, blazing a trail, clearing a way to the future. A future that will be more secure, more prosperous, and just all around better because of them. Posterity will revere them. That's the spiel. Stan has never heard so much bullshit in his life. On the other hand, he sort of wants to believe it. The final speaker is older than the Zitty youths, though not that much older. His suit is of the same darkness, but it looks lusher. He's narrow-shouldered, long torso, short legs. Short hair, too, clippered around the neck, combed back. The look says, "I am buttoned down." There's a woman with him, also in a dark suit, with straight black hair and bangs and a squarish jaw. No makeup, but she does have earrings. Her legs are good, though muscular. She sits to the side, fooling with her cell phone. Is she an assistant? It isn't clear. Stan pegs her as Butch. Technically, she shouldn't have been here, in the men's sessions, and Stan wonders why she is. Still, better to look at her than at the guy. The guy begins by saying they should call him Ed. Ed hopes they're feeling comfortable, because they know, as he does, that they've made the right choice. Now he would like to give them, share with them, a deeper peek behind the scenes. It was a struggle to get the multiple permissions needed to set up the Positron Enterprise. The powers that be did not decide easily. More than one policy guru's ass was on the line. He smirks a little at his own daring use of the word ass, as witness the howling when the scheme was first announced in the press. The spokesmen, or rather the spokespersons, Ed glances at the woman who smiles, have braved a lot of indignant screaming from the online radicals and malcontents who claim that Consilience Positron is an infringement of individual liberties, an attempt at total social control, an insult to the human spirit. Nobody is more dedicated to individual liberties than Ed is, but as they all know, here Ed gives a conspiratorial smile, you can't eat your so-called individual liberties, and the human spirit pays no bills, and something needed to be done to relieve the pressure inside the social pressure cooker. Wouldn't they agree? The woman in the suit glances up. What's she looking at? Her gaze sweeps over them, calm, cool. Then she turns back to her cell phone. Without a phone himself, Stan feels naked. They'd had to turn in their cells at the beginning of the workshop. They've been promised new ones, but those will work only inside the wall. Stan wonders when the new ones will be issued. Ed lowers his voice. Serious stuff coming up. Sure enough, on comes a PowerPoint with a slew of graphs. The financial big guns have concealed the true statistics to avoid panic, he says. But a shocking 40% of the population in this region is jobless, with 50% of those being under 25. That's a recipe for systems breakdown right there. For anarchy. For chaos. For the senseless destruction of property. For so-called revolution, which means looting and gang rule and warlords and mass rape and the terrorization of the weak and helpless. That is the grim prospect staring everyone in this area right between the eyes. They've already noticed the symptoms for themselves, which is, he is sure, why they saw the desirability of signing in. What can be done? Ed asks, wrinkling his brows. How to keep the lid on? Which it was in the interests of society at large to do, as they would surely agree. At the official leadership level, ideas were running out fast. There is only so much manpower and tax revenue that can be devoted to riot control, to social surveillance, to chasing fast youths down dark alleyways, to fire-hosing and pepper-spraying suspicious-looking gatherings. Too many once-bustling cities are stagnant or derelict, especially in the Northeast. But other states are being hard-hit, especially where long droughts have taken their toll. Too many of the disenfranchised are living in abandoned cars or subway tunnels or even in culverts. There's an epidemic of drugging and boozing. Suicide-grade alcohol, skin-blistering drugs that kill you in under a year. Oblivion is increasingly attractive to the young and even to the middle-aged, since why retain your brain when no amount of thinking can even begin to solve the problem? It isn't even a problem. It's beyond a problem. It's more like a looming collapse. Is their once beautiful region, their once beautiful country, doomed to be a wasteland of poverty and debris? At first, the solution was to build more prisons and cram more people into them. But that soon became prohibitively expensive. Here, Ed flicks through a few more slides. Not only that, it resulted in platoons of prison graduates with professional-grade criminal skills they were more than willing to exercise once they were back in the outside world. Even when the prisons were privatized, even when the prisoners were rented out as unpaid labor to international business interests, the cost-benefit charts did not improve because American slave workers couldn't outperform the slave workers in other countries. Competitiveness in the slave labor market was linked to the price of food, and Americans, who remain good-hearted despite everything, stray puppy rescuers every one, here Ed smiles indulgently, contemptuously, weren't ready to starve their prisoners to death while working them to the bone. No matter how much the prisoners were vilified by the politicians and the press as filthy dregs and toxic scum, still, heaps of stick-legged corpses can't be hidden from view indefinitely. The odd unexplained death, maybe. There has always been the odd unexplained death, says Ed, shrugging. But not heaps. Some snoop would make a phone video. Such things can escape, despite the best attempts to keep things under hatches. And who knows what sort of uproar, not to mention uprising, might result. Stan feels a small prickle at the back of his neck. That's his brother, Ed could be talking about. Or maybe not Khan specifically, but he's pretty sure that if Ed got a close-up look at Khan, he'd file him under toxic scum. It's fine for Stan to use names like that. It's within the family. And it's not that he approves of whatever it is Khan is probably doing. But is this the kind of rumor Khan's been hearing? That Positron is hardcore repressive on the subject of sticky fingers? One strike and you're out? He'd like to phone Connor, talk to him some more, see what he knows about this place really. But he can't do that without a phone. Wait and see, he tells himself. Give the place a chance. Ed opens his arms like a TV preacher. His voice gets louder. Then it occurred to the planners of Positron, he says, and this was brilliant, that if prisons were scaled out and handled rationally, they could be win-win viable economic units. So many jobs could be spawned by them. Construction jobs, maintenance jobs, cleaning jobs, guard jobs, hospital jobs, uniform sewing jobs, shoemaking jobs, jobs in agriculture, if there was a farm attached, an ever-flowing cornucopia of jobs. Medium-sized towns with large penitentiaries could maintain themselves, and the people inside such towns could live in middle-class comfort. And if every citizen were either a guard or a prisoner, the result would be full employment. Half would be prisoners, the other half would be engaged in the business of tending the prisoners in some way or other, or tending those who tended them. And since it was unrealistic to expect certified criminality from 50% of the population, the fair thing would be for everyone to take turns. 1 month in, 1 month out. Think of the savings, with every dwelling serving two sets of residents. It was timeshare taken to its logical conclusion. Hence, the twin town of Consilience Positron, of which they are now all such an important part. Ed smiles, the welcoming, open, inclusive smile of a born salesman. It all makes sense. Stan wants to ask about the profit margin, and about whether this thing is a private venture. It has to be. Someone's got the lucrative infrastructure and supply contracts. Walls don't build themselves. And the security systems are top grade, from what he's been able to observe at the gateway. But he stops himself. This doesn't feel like the right moment to ask, because now a great big Consilience has come up on the screen. Consilience equals cons plus resilience. Do time now. Buy time for our future. A meaningful life. Stan has to admit that the PR team and the Branders have done well. Ed obviously thinks so too. Positron Project had changed the name of the pre-existing prison, he tells them, because the Upstate Correctional Institute was dingy and boring. They'd come up with Positron, which technically means the antimatter counterpart of the electron, but few out there would know that, would they? As a word, it just sounded very, well, positive. And positivity was what was needed to solve our current problems. Even the most cynical, says Ed, even the most jaundiced would have to admit that. Then they'd brought in some top designers to consult on an overall look and feel. The 50s was chosen for the visual and audio aspects because that was the decade in which the most people had self-identified as being happy. Which is one of the goals here. Maximum possible happiness. Who wouldn't tick that box? When the new name and the new aesthetic were launched, Positron hit a popular nerve. Credible stratagem, said the online news bloggers. At last, a vision. Even the depressives among them said why not try it, since nothing else had worked. People were starved for hope, ready to swallow anything uplifting. After they'd run the first TV ads, the number of online applications was overwhelming. And no wonder. There were so many advantages. Who wouldn't rather eat well 3 times a day, and have a shower with more than a cupful of water, and wear clean clothes and sleep in a comfortable bed devoid of bedbugs? Not to mention the inspiring sense of a shared purpose. Rather than festering in some deserted condo, crawling with black mold, or crouching in a stench-filled trailer where you'd spend the nights beating off dead-eyed teenagers armed with broken bottles and ready to murder you for a handful of cigarette butts, you'd have gainful employment, 3 wholesome meals a day, a lawn to tend, a hedge to trim, the assurance that you were contributing to the general good, and a toilet that flushed. In a word, or rather 3 words, a meaningful life. That was the last slogan on the last slide on the last PowerPoint. Something to take home with them, says Ed. Their new home. Right here inside Consilience. And inside Positron, of course. Think of an egg with a white and a yolk. An egg came up on screen. A knife cut it in half lengthwise. Consilience is the white. Positron is the yolk. And together, they make the whole egg. The nest egg, says Ed, smiling. There's a final picture. A nest with a golden egg shining within it. Ed turns off the PowerPoint, puts on his reading glasses, consults a list. Practical matters. Their new cell phones will be issued in the main hall. At the same time, they'll receive their housing allocations. The details are explained more fully on the green sheets in their folders, but in brief, everyone in Consilience will live 2 lives. Prisoners 1 month, guards or town functionaries the next. Everyone has been assigned an alternate. 1 detached residential dwelling can therefore serve at least 4 people. In month 1, the houses will be occupied by the civilians, and then in month 2, by the prisoners of month 1, who will take on the civilian roles and move into the houses. And so it will go, month after month, turn and turn about. Think of the savings in the cost of living, Ed says, with what is either a tick or a wink. As for purchasing power, always a hot topic, each of them will be given an initial number of posi-dollars, which can be exchanged for items they may wish to purchase at the Consilient shops or from the internal network digital catalog. The sum will be topped up automatically every payday. Objects purchased to individualize the living spaces may either be stored during prison time or shared with alternates. In case of breakage, the alternates will, of course, replace such items using their own posi-dollars. There is a maintenance staff that will take care of such things as plumbing and electrical issues, and leaks, Ed says. The roof kind, not the information kind, he adds with a smile. This is supposed to be a joke, Stan guesses. He takes a quick look at the green sheet. Single people will live in 2-bedroom condos, which they will share with another single person and their 2 alternates. Detached houses are reserved for couples and families. Good. He and Charmaine will get one of those. Teens have 2 schools, 1 inside the prison, 1 outside it. Young children stay with the mothers in the women's wing, equipped with supervised play schools, kindergartens, and toddler dance classes. It's really an ideal situation for young children, and so far the parental satisfaction index is very high. Each dwelling unit has 4 lockers, 1 for each adult. Civilian clothes, which may be selected from the catalog, are stored in these lockers during the months when their owners are doing a prisoner shift. The orange prisoner garb is kept at the Positron prison, worn while in prison, and left there for cleaning. The prison cells themselves have been upgraded, and though care has been taken to maintain the theme, considerable amenities have been added. It's not as if they're being asked to live in an old-fashioned sort of prison. The prison food, for instance, is at least 3-star quality. He himself enjoys nothing more because it's amazing what care and a top attitude can add to simple and wholesome ingredients. Ed consults his notes. Stan shifts from cheek to cheek. How long is this windbag going to go on? He's got the picture, and so far there's nothing to freak out about. He could use a coffee. Better, a beer. He wonders what they've been telling Charmaine over in the ladies' workshops.
Right. Another thing, says Ed. From time to time, a film crew may arrive to shoot some footage of the ideal life they will all be leading, to be shown outside Consilience as a boost to the helpful work they are doing here. They themselves will be able to view those results, too, on the closed-circuit Consilience network. Music and movies are available on the same network, although, to avoid overexcitement, there is no pornography or undue violence, and no rock or hip-hop. However, there is no limitation on string quartets, Bing Crosby, Doris Day, the Mills Brothers, or show tunes from vintage Hollywood musicals. Fuck, thinks Stan. Granny junk. What about sports? Will they be able to watch any games? He wonders if there's any way of picking up a signal from outside. What's bad about football? But maybe not trying anything like that too soon. A couple more things, says Ed. There's a sign-up list for preferred jobs, in prison and in town. They should number their three top choices, with 10 being the most preferred. Those who've never driven a scooter should sign up on the yellow sheet. The scooter classes will begin on Tuesday. Scooters are color-matched to lockers, and all individuals must take personal responsibility for their scooter while it is in their care. He, Ed, is sure they will make a great success of this revolutionary new venture. Good luck. He gives a wave of the hand, like Santa Claus, then leaves the room. The woman in the dark suit walks behind him. Maybe she's a bodyguard, Stan thinks. Powerful glutes. When he gets to the list of jobs, Stan chooses robotics first. After that, IT. And third, scooter repair. He figures he could do any one of them. Just so long as he doesn't end up in kitchen cleanup, he'll be fine. That evening, he and Charmaine do their first shopping with their posi-dollars and share their first meal in their new abode. Charmaine can't get over it. She's so happy she's warbling. She wants to open all the closet doors, turn on all the appliances. She can hardly wait to see what sorts of jobs they'll be given, and she's signed herself up for scooter lessons. It will all be so terrific.
Let's go to bed, says Stan. She's spinning out of control. He feels he needs a butterfly net to catch her. She's so hyper.
I'm just too excited, she says.
As if, thinks Stan. He wishes he were the object of that excitement, and not the dishwasher, which she's now cooing over as if it's a kitten. He can't shake the feeling that this place is some sort of pyramid scheme, and that those who fail to understand that will be left empty-handed. But there's no obvious reason for this feeling of his. Maybe he's ungrateful by nature. I'm starved for you. Stan's lost count of the exact time they've been inside the Twin Cities. You can get into a drifting mode. Has a year gone by already? More than a year. He's repaired scooters 1 month, dealt with egg-counting software in prison the next, then back to the scooters. Nothing he hasn't been able to handle. He's listening to Paper Doll on his phone earbuds while rinsing out his coffee cup. Those flirty guys, he hums to himself. At first he hated the music in Consilience, but he's begun to find it oddly consoling. Doris Day is even kind of a turn-on. Today is switchover day, when he and Charmaine both go into the prison. How does she pass the time away from him inside the women's wing?
We knit a lot, she's told him. In the off hours. And there are the vegetable gardens and the cooking. We take turns at those daily things. And the laundry, of course. And then at the hospital. My job is chief medications administrator. It's a big responsibility. I'm never bored. The days just fly by.
Do you miss me? Stan asked her a week ago. When you're in there.
Of course I miss you. Don't be silly, she said, kissing him on the nose.
But a nose kiss wasn't what he wanted.
Do you hunger for me? Do you burn for me? That's what he'd like to ask. But he doesn't dare ask that, because he's almost certain she would laugh. It's not that they don't have sex. They certainly have more of it than they had in the car. But it's sex that Charmaine enacts, like yoga, with careful breath control. What he wants is sex that can't be helped. He wants helplessness. No, no, no. Yes, yes, yes. That's what he wants. He's come to realize that in recent months. Down in the cellar, he opens the large green locker and stows away the clothes he's been wearing for summer. The shorts, the t-shirts, the jeans. He may not be using these for a while. By the time he gets back here next month, the hot weather may be over and he'll be into the fleece pullovers, though you never know with September. He won't have to do so much lawn maintenance then, which is a plus, though the lawn will be a wreck. Some guys have no feeling for lawns. They take them for granted. They let them mat up and dry out, and then the yellow ants get into them, and it takes a lot of work to bring the grass back. If he were here all the time, he could keep the lawn in peak condition. Upstairs, clean towels are deployed in the bathroom. Clean sheets are on the bed. Charmaine did that before she set off on her scooter for Positron. In the past couple of months, he's been leaving the house after she does, so he does the final check. No bathtub ring, no orphaned sock, no ends of soap or wispy gatherings of shed hair on the floor. When they return on the first day of every second month, Stan and Charmaine are supposed to find the house pristine, spotless, hinting of lemon-scented cleaning products, and Charmaine likes to leave it that way. She says they should lead by example. It certainly hasn't been spotless every time they've returned. As Charmaine has pointed out, there have been hairs, there have been toast crumbs, there have been smudges. More than that, 3 months ago, Stan found a folded note. The corner was sticking out from under the refrigerator. It might originally have been attached with the silver fridge magnet in the shape of a duck, the same one Charmaine uses to post shopping reminders. Despite the strict consilient's taboo against contact with alternates, he read the note immediately. Though it was done on a printer, it was shockingly intimate. "Darling Max, I can hardly wait till next time. I'm starved for you. I need you so much. XXOO. And you know what more. Jasmine." There was a lipstick kiss. Hot pink. No, darker. Some kind of purple. Not violet. Not mauve. Not maroon. He riffled through his head, trying to recall the names of the colors on the paint chips and fabric swatches Charmaine spent so much time brooding over. He lifted the paper to his nose, breathed in. Still a faint scent. Like cherry bubblegum. Charmaine has never worn lipstick that color. And she's never written him a note like that. He dropped it into the trash as if it was burning, but then fished it out and slid it back under the refrigerator. Jasmine shouldn't know that her note to Max had been intercepted. Also, it's possible Max looks under the fridge for such notes. It might be a kinky little game they play, and Max would be upset not to find it. "Did you get my note?" Jasmine would say to him as they lay stuck together. "What note?" Max would answer. "Oh my God, one of them found it," Jasmine would exclaim. Then she would laugh. It might even turn her on, the consciousness of a third pair of eyes having seen the imprint of her avid mouth. Not that she needs turning on. Stan can't stop thinking about that. About Jasmine. About her mouth. It's bad enough here at the house, even with Charmaine breathing beside him, lightly or heavily, depending on what they're doing, or rather on what he's doing. Charmaine has never been much of a joiner, more of a sidelines woman, cheering him on from a distance. But at Positron, in his narrow bed in the men's wing,
That kiss floats in the darkness before his open eyes, like four plush pillows, parted invitingly, as if about to sigh or speak. He knows the color of that mouth by now. He's tracked it down. Fuchsia. It has a moist, luscious feel to it. "Oh, hurry," that mouth says. "I need you. I need you now. I'm starved for you." But it's speaking to Stan, not to the guy whose clothes repose in the locker beside his own. Not to Max. Max and Jasmine. Those are their names. The names of the alternates, the two others who occupy the house, walk through its routines, cater to its demands, act out its fantasies of normal life when he and Charmaine aren't there. He isn't supposed to know those names or anything at all about their owners. That's Consilient's protocol. But because of the note, he does know the names. And by now he knows, or deduces, or more accurately, imagines, a lot of other things as well. Max's locker is the red one. Charmaine's locker is pink. Jasmine's is purple. In an hour or so, once Stan has left the house, once he's logged out, Max will walk in through the front door, open the red locker, take out his stored clothes, carry them upstairs, arrange them in the bedroom, on the shelves, in the closet. Enough for a month's stay. Then, Jasmine will arrive. She won't bother with her locker. Not at first. They'll throw themselves into each other's arms. No, Jasmine will throw herself into Max's arms, press herself against him, open her fuchsia mouth, tear off Max's clothes and her own, pull him down onto, what, the living room carpet? Or will they stumble upstairs, reeling with lust, and fall entwined onto the bed, so thoughtfully and neatly made up with newly ironed sheets by Charmaine before she left? Sheets with a border of birthday party bluebirds tying pink ribbon bows. Nursery sheets, kitty sheets, Charmaine's idea of cuteness. Those sheets don't seem right for Max and Jasmine, who would never choose such bland pastel accessories for themselves. Black satin is more their style. Though, like all the basics in the place, the sheets came with the house. Jasmine isn't a sheet ironer, nor does she make up the bed for Stan and Charmaine before she leaves. They find the mattress bare and no towels set out in the bathroom either. But of course, Jasmine is lax about such household details, thinks Stan, because all she really cares about is sex. Stan rearranges Jasmine and Max in his head, this way and that. Lace bra ripped asunder, legs in the air, hair wildly tangled, even though he has no idea what either of them looks like. Max's back is covered with scratch marks, like a cat fancier's leather sofa. What a slut, that Jasmine. Flaming hot in an instant, like an induction cooker. He can't stand it. Maybe she's ugly. Ugly, 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 he repeats like a charm, trying to exorcise her. Her and her maddening bubblegum lipstick smell and her musky voice, a voice he's never heard. But it doesn't work, because she's not ugly. She's beautiful. She's so beautiful, she glows in the dark. No such pranks with Charmaine. No blistering fuchsia kisses, no rolling around on the carpet. A month from now, it'll be, "Stanley! Stan! Honey! I'm here!" In a light, clear voice, a voice without undertones. Charmaine, wearing her blue and white striped shirt, so crisp, with its faint undercent of bleach, and its overtone of baby powder-themed fabric softener. He wouldn't have her any other way. That's why he married her. She was an escape from the many-layered, devious, ironic, hot-cold women he'd tangled himself up with until then. Women too open to being raided by Connor, and by others as well. Transparency, certainty, fidelity. His various humiliations had taught him to value those. He liked the retro thing about Charmaine. The cookie ad thing. Her prissiness. The way she hardly ever swore. When they'd got married, they'd pictured kids, once they could afford them. They still do picture them. Maybe that will happen soon, now that they're no longer living in their car. He keys in the code on his locker, waits for it to flash closed, climbs the cellar stairs, leaves the house. Once outside, he taps a second code into the signal pad beside the door, coding himself out. Over at Positron, Jasmine and Max must already have changed into the civvies they stored there last month. Now they must be checking out of their prison wings and ditching their orange prison uniforms at the main desk. Very soon, they'll hop onto their scooters and make their way to this house. Stan has a voyeur's urge to hide behind the hedge, that cedar hedge he trimmed last week, tidying up the slapdash job done by Max during his last sojourn. He'll wait until they're both inside, then peer through the windows. He's figured out the sight lines. He's left the ground floor blinds up a crack. If they go upstairs, though, he'll have no options but to set up the extension ladder, and he knows how screechy and metallic that would be. And what if he falls off? Worse, if Max leans out the window stark naked and pushes him off. He doesn't know anything about Max, except from what's implied in that note. Also, Max had first choice of lockers, and he chose the red one. He must be aggressive. Stan wouldn't wish to be pushed off an extension ladder by an angry naked man, a naked man to whose rippling epidermis he now adds copious tattoos. Most likely, Max also has a shaved head, covered in scars and welts from all the times he's broken men's teeth and jaws with the sheer force of his bullet-shaped skull. Stan's own skull still has a cushion of sandy hair, but it's thinning, even though he's only 32. He's never used his skull to butt anyone in the mouth, though he's willing to bet Max has. Most likely, Max once worked as a bodyguard for some black-jacketed, gold-chained, coke-pushing, girl-enslaving money lord in his life before Positron. Someone like Connor, only a larger, tougher, meaner, more powerful Connor. On level ground, Stan might be able to hold his own against such a man, but on that ladder, he'd be off balance, and he'd land in the hedge, bashing a jagged hole in it, after all his careful trimming. That asswipe Max is even worse with the hedge than he is with the lawn. Stan found the hedge trimmer in the garage, its blade gummed up with slaughtered foliage. But there's no chance Max is able to focus on hedge trimming, since Jasmine leaps on the poor sod every time she sees him in his leather work gloves and starts pawing at his belt buckle. All things considered, better not to peer in the window.
Switch. It's a beautiful, cloudless day. Not too hot for the 1st of August. Charmaine finds switchover days almost festive. When it's not raining, the streets are full of people, smiling, greeting one another, some walking, some on their color-coded scooters, the odd one in a golf cart. Now and then, one of the dark surveillance cars glides through them. There are more of those cars on switchover days. Everyone seems quite happy. Having two lives means there's always something different to look forward to. It's like having a vacation every month. But which life is the vacation and which is the work? Charmaine hardly knows. Making her way to the Consilience Town Pharmacy on her pink and purple electric scooter, she checks her watch. She doesn't have much time. She needs to key in at Positron by 5:30 at the latest, and it's already 3. She told Stan she had to do some ordering for the prison hospital. That's why she was in a rush to leave the house. The month before last, her excuse was slip covers. Didn't he agree about the slip covers? Weren't they a drab color? Shouldn't they both go and view the selection and put in a requisition for something more cheerful? You can't really tell from a digital image. You have to see them in person. Look, She has some fabric swatches. A floral or maybe an abstract motif. Anything along those lines, and Stan zones out. And she can count on his not having heard a word she's said. He'd notice her if she were to suddenly disappear, but he doesn't register her much otherwise. Lately, he's been treating her like white noise, like the rivulet sound on their sleep machine. This would once have hurt her, did hurt her, but now it suits her fine. She parks the scooter in the lot behind the pharmacy, then walks around to the front. Already her heart is beating faster. She takes a breath, assumes her bustling, efficient pose, consults her little notebook as if there's something written in it. Then she orders a large box of gauze bandages, putting it on the hospital account. The bandages aren't needed, but they're also not remarkable. No one will be keeping track of gauze bandages, especially since keeping track of them happens to be her own job every other month. She smiles in her sunniest manner at Bill Nairn, who's putting in his last hour as pharmacist before shedding his white coat and taking up whatever role he plays inside the positron prison walls. Bill smiles back, and they exchange remarks about the lovely weather, then close with goodbyes. She smiles again. She has such guileless teeth, asexual teeth, nothing fanged about them. She used to worry about looking so symmetrical, so blonde, but she's come to think of this as an asset. Her small teeth alarm no one. Bland is good camouflage. She hurries back to the lot, and sure enough, there's a small envelope tucked in under the scooter seat. She palms it, fishtails out of the lot, makes it around the corner to a residential street, parks. They don't use their consilience-issue cell phones to arrange these meetings. It's too risky, because you never know what the central IT people are tracking. The whole town is under a bell jar. Communications can be exchanged inside it, but no words get in or out except through approved gateways. No whines, no complaints, no tattling, no whistleblowing. The overall message must be tightly controlled. The outside world must be assured that the Consilience Positron Twin City project is working. And it is working. Because look, safe streets, no homelessness, jobs for all. Though there were some bumps along the way, and those bumps had to be flattened out, but right now, Charmaine doesn't intend to dwell on those discouraging bumps, or on the nature of the flattening. She unfolds the paper, reads the address. She'll dispose of the note by burning it, though not out here in the open. A woman on a scooter setting fire to something might attract notice. There aren't any black cars in view, but it's rumored that surveillance can see around corners. Today's address is in a housing development left over from some decade in the mid-20th century, one of the many relics from the town's past. As they've all been informed in the backgrounders, the town that's now become Consilience was founded in the late 19th century by a group of Quakers. Brotherly love was what they'd wanted. The town's name was Harmony. Its crest was a beehive, meaning cooperative labor. The first industry was a beet sugar mill. Next came a furniture factory, then a corset company. Then there was an automobile plant, one of those pre-Ford cars. Then a camera film corporation, and finally, a state correctional institution. After the Second World War, the key industries faded until nothing was left of Harmony but a gutted downtown, several crumbling public buildings with white columns, and a lot of repossessed houses not even the banks could sell. And, of course, the correctional institution, which was where the inhabitants had worked, when they'd worked at all. But now, thinks Charmaine, it's all different. Such an improvement. Already, the gym has been renovated, for instance. And a whole bunch of houses are being upgraded. A fresh batch of applicants will arrive any month now to fill them. Or maybe to fill the houses that aren't so upgraded, such as the one she and Stan had lived in at first. There had been plumbing problems, more like plumbing events, since they were bigger than mere problems. There was the time when it rained so hard and the sewage came spouting up through the kitchen sink. That was bigger than just a problem. Luckily,